Welcome to ITE 1, Module 15, Part 2. We're talking about advanced networking concepts. And last time, which was yesterday, we talked about network design. So what kind of things we need to pick out. And now we're going to talk about implementing the network. Small home network installation can become difficult and time-consuming. Oh, this is absolutely true. Has anyone ever had to install a home network with more than one router or switch and had all that kind of fun?
Fortunately, no.
Oh, well, that can be absolutely fantastic. I planned and implemented a network last year, and I had fun trying to figure out, I had a wireless modem / router that the ISP had given me. I bought a new switch and router as well, for upstairs, a wireless router, and I just couldn't figure out why half the time I wasn't getting internet. And then I realized I had two DHCP servers going, and wasn't.
Oh, yeah.
I recall being on Skype for that.
Yeah. When you're doing a network, there will be some downtime, of course, because you're going to be unplugging and plugging in cables, and you're going to be taking bits of the network down while actually replacing things. So you're definitely going to want to warn your users and make sure to do it at a time that is as convenient as possible for them. And
unfortunately, in a home network, there never seems to be a time that's convenient for everybody. Because I have to have my internet now!
If you do it in the middle of the night, it's not too bad. Usually most people fall to bed and stuff. And the other thing with home networks, and I wouldn't recommend this for a business network, is when people go, I don't have any internet! You just go, I don't know. It'll be back soon.
I usually just say, reset the router.
So, what was I saying? Okay. Now you've got, the locations of everything, what you're basically going to do, now it's time to actually install it. If you're going to install the cable yourself, hey, tip, you're not. You've got to get all of the necessary materials available because you don't want to be running things through ductwork and going into little tight spaces and not have something and have to go get it and drop everything.
On the bright side, blind people don't tend to need a torch.
Okay,
flashlight
here are the
over here.
Yep. Here are the steps to install a network. To install the cable and the ceilings inside the walls, you perform a cable pull.
Sorry about mortgage.
You don't. You're fine. One person pulls the cable, and another person feeds in the cable through the wall. Make sure to label the ends of every cable. Follow a labeling scheme that is already in place, or follow the guidelines in TIA/EIA 606A. I don't even know what that standard is, unfortunately, but hey, I guess they have some cabling outlines in there. If your cables have been terminated at both ends, use a cable tester to make sure that there are no shorts or interference. Because once you close this up, you're not getting it back out again easily. Make sure that the network interfaces are properly installed in the desktops, laptops, and network printers. After you've installed the network interfaces, configure the client software and the IP address information on all of the devices, if you're not going to DHCP. Install switches and routers in a secure, centralized location. All of the LAN connections terminate in this area. In a home network, you may need to install these devices in separate locations, or you may have only one device. For example, in mine, we had most of the stuff in a locked cabinet in the basement, but the wireless router was upstairs, so we could actually use it. Install an an Ethernet patch cable from the wall connection to each network device, unless you've got the smart wiring going on. Check to see if you have a link light on all network interfaces and each network device port that connects to a device, or just manually test them because you can't see light and don't have a light probe. When all devices are connected and all link lights are functioning, test the network for connectivity. Yeah, we just skip that if we can't see light. Use the ipconfig/all command to view the IP configuration on each workstation. Now, Kerry had another command that I can't remember that he was showing me last week that would just show the connected IP addresses. Do you remember what was that?
That was ipconfig /all bar find space quote address quote, and that will just give you the lines with the word address in them. There's a DOS find command. You can do a find /?. I think that was the command I gave you.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, it was, because you did a pipe command and it showed you just the IP addresses, the lines that contained IP address.
So if you have a whole lot of different connections and you use like OpenVPN, that might be something you could use just to have a quick look.
The other thing I'd recommend is if you're not using IPv6 and you're running Vista or better, turn it off. It causes more problems than it solves, and it does cause issues with the V4 stack.
How does one go about it? Well, I suppose that's Googleable.
I spoke to my friend, a CSIRO CSIRO computer technician who was going through some of the problems that it causes and how it can cause DNS to use quadruple A records instead of A records, and if there are quadruple A records for things that are wrong, it will then go off and go to the wrong places, and if it can't do certain things, other interesting things happen. So unless your network is IPv6 ready and you've got something like an advertising daemon running like RADF, I wouldn't bother. If you are IPv6 ready, by all means, check the boxes, turn it back on again. Anyone running IPv6?
So I take it it's pretty easy to turn it off and back on again. That's what I wasn't sure of.
Oh, checkbox in the network components. You go IPv6 protocol, checkbox checked, spacebar, okay, gone.
It's like turning off NetBUI or Microsoft file sharing.
Use the ping command to detect basic connectivity. You should be able to ping other computers on the network, including the default gateway and remote computers. Now, if this doesn't work, why shouldn't you panic?
Because in Windows, the ping is canonically disabled.
Sort of. If you've got Windows Firewall on, you're not going to be able to ping. So, it'll just send back and nothing will happen because you can't. It doesn't allow ping requests. So, that is why you
Hang
should...
on.
What?
I think if you ping with Windows Firewall on from a machine with Windows Firewall on, you will see the responses. Anybody confirm or deny?
Yeah, I think you're right. I've never turned it off, and I've always pinged lots of things in it.
Yeah, you can't ping the Windows boxes, Grace. You can't ping a Windows box with the firewall on, but you can ping from a Windows box to something else, and if it's not another Windows box with the firewall on, it is smart enough to allow the return ICMP back.
Fair enough. After you're sure that it is connected, you want to configure and test the network applications, your email, an internet browser, anything else. You want to make any
exceptions. Can I just point out how important pinging the default gateway is? My router kept dying really, really frequently, and pinging that default gateway was the quickest way to find out whether it was actually working or not. So that's very useful, and I got very thankful I knew how to do that. And Tomato has fixed that problem. It has not died once since I flashed it. But
yeah, I had the same thing happen 2 days ago.
Oh, I hate that.
I had the internet got cut out for about an hour, and the router would... I know it's the modem or my ISP and not the router, because the default gateway was pingable.
Okay, the other thing that they're not really talking about too much here is that if your customer uses specialized software and they've got a firewall, you've got to go do the port forwarding or creating exceptions, depending on the firewall and how it does it, for the network applications that you're using. Or else your customer won't be able to use their network like they would want to. All right, next you've got to configure your internet browser. We go through some of the things that we can do. Most of these internet browsers just have setup wizards that you go through or your customer goes to customize them the way you want. If a customer is actually using this PC, I think I'd let them go through the wizard because it's pretty much harmless and there's nothing they're really going to be able to do to muck the wizard up. They'll just be able to personalize Internet Explorer the way they like it.
In a corporate environment, that usually is shut down because you don't want people breaking their own browsers, because everybody knows what's wrong with their computer and they're going to fix it themselves to save the technician some bother. And then when they've done that, the technician will then have some more bother to sort out. So at home you can probably leave it on. Also on limited disk space installs you can actually use the Internet Explorer Administration Kit. It's one of those things that exists that not a lot of people know about, and it lets you customize exactly which bits of the browser are and aren't installed, and you can make yourself a custom installer with all of the home pages and everything set by default. And that's kind of cool.
Okay. We all know that Windows installs Internet Explorer by default. They still do that. You're not going to get anything else by default, but at least they give you an internet browser so you can go download all of the other stuff.
How do you get WordPad?
Yeah, you do get WordPad, but you don't get email anymore or any of that.
That was
the
an antitrust
European
case.
The European
Union
has changed that, actually.
Yeah, well, that was an antitrust case, that one. They're already in hot water about bundling Internet Explorer with the operating system. And given the probes by the EU about anti-competitive behaviour, that's one of the reasons why they took the default mail clients off the desktop, because it was seen as unfair to the other providers of email clients that you already got one with the operating system. Why this doesn't matter for OS X is beyond me, but hey.
Yeah.
Who knows? We don't ask.
You look at OS X, it comes with Safari and Mac Mail by default, and nobody's jumped on them about it.
It's because, Carrie, Apple is the good giant OS company that bundles programs.
Oh, sorry, Drew, I had momentarily forgotten that pearl of wisdom. I'm glad you reminded me.
That's what I'm here for.
Moving right along.
All right.
What I think is cool is that actually you can open .dox files in Notepad with no problems, but doc is all sorts of weird garbage characters. Maybe it's just the Windows 7 thing, but yeah, like I opened a .dox file and it was like perfect. There was no weird garbage characters at the top or anything. It just opened right up. It was great.
That's kind of cool.
DOCX, by the way. But that's
I wonder if that'll work in XP.
Yeah.
No, it's
probably
not.
You could give it a go.
Maybe in Vista, though. This is an XML format. You could see the XML in Notepad, I think.
Oh, okay.
Which wouldn't really help you get at the text very much.
Could you just rename it to XML and try it?
Well, you could. You could try it. You've got virtual machines. Give it a go. Well, you don't anymore, but yeah, these things are tryable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Your browser downloads temporary files, which are images, banners for websites, all of that good stuff. These are stored on your computer so that your browser can load these sites more quickly when you next visit them. Depending on the number of websites you go to, the temporary files folder can fill up quickly and take up a bunch of room on your machine. While this might not be a huge urgent problem, you should probably delete the files occasionally just to clean up all of the stuff. This is especially important after you enter personal information into your browser.
It's
you
funny
can
to see somebody who hasn't emptied their temp file because they never knew to do it, so it's gone months and months and possibly years, and how long it takes.
Has anybody... I believe the default for Internet Explorer 8 for temporary files has been reduced to 20 meg. However, it is not reduced when you do an upgrade. So I think they've actually shrunk the temporary files on the hard disk down lower because so many websites are using dynamic uncacheable content, which is evil.
Yeah.
The other thing I think in 8 is that save encrypted pages is on or off by default. So that any of your cool banking information and all that stuff that comes over SSL is not cached.
Sweet, that's good.
As it shouldn't be.
Was that always by default in earlier versions? That's filthy.
That's pretty moronic,
I mean,
right there.
Squid doesn't cache SSL.
I don't
SSL.
Think it was. I didn't think it was on.
I don't remember seeing a setting exposed in the interface for it. I think Brian could be right. I think it's certainly now off.
No, the setting was there, but I don't think it was on. I've seen the setting. I think.
Where? Privacy?
Privacy.
Advanced. The one that nobody looks at.
Oh, we all look at it, Sean.
We all do.
Just
we
kidding.
All turn the pictures thing on.
I do. That doesn't work well, though, if you're trying to use WebVism, so don't do it with Firefox and try and solve a WebVism. That's pretty funny.
Okay. You can confirm which browser uses the default in Windows by choosing Start, Run, Enter a Website Address, and click OK. Okay. In Windows Vista, you do the same sort of thing in the search box. The website opens in the browser that is currently set as the default. If you want IE to be your default browser, open up IE, and on the toolbar, you select Tools, Internet Options, Programs, and place a check in the box next to tell me if Internet Explorer is not the default web browser. The next time you click a web link in a program or in a document, you'll be asked if you would like to make Internet Explorer your default web browser. Okay. File sharing. You can share resources over the network. You can use a single file, specific folder, or an entire drive. Now, in sharing your C drive might not be the very best idea, but I know lots of people who do it. To share a file in Windows XP, you should first copy it to a folder, right-click the folder, and select Sharing and Security. Next, you're going to select Share this folder, and you can choose who has access to the folder, what permissions they have on the things in the folder, and all of that good stuff. In Vista 7, right-click the folder, select Sharing, add a user to the folder, and then select Share. Permissions define the type of access a user has to a file or folder. Now, this is testable, guys. Can anyone tell me what read allows you to do?
Look at the contents, but do nothing else to it?
Yep, that's basically it. This allows you to view the file and subfolder names, navigate to subfolders, and view data in files, and also you can run folders. So in Windows, you can think of it as read and execute. In Linux, I think there's a whole separate setting for executing files.
Yeah, but execute does something different on directories, so let's not go there.
Change. What do you think change allows you to do?
Modify the contents of files.
I'll add, modify, and delete. Absolutely. Full control. This allows permissions of change and read. If file or folder is an NTFS partition, full control allows you to change permissions on the file or folder and take ownership of the file or folder. So that is the difference.
So if it's set to change, you can delete stuff and add stuff, but you can't decide whose
change
stuff it is.
Yeah, basically. And you
that's
can't
what full
change
control
the
does.
Yeah, that's basically it.
Okay, that's
keep
always
in mind
gotten
that
me, so hopefully I
full control allows, as the notes say, that you to take owner of the file. If the file is owned by someone else and you don't have write permissions on that object, you are not able to change the permissions on that object as you would in Windows. So to be able to change the owner of the file, you can actually have to take ownership of the file, and then you can change the permissions. So if anybody's moved an NTFS formatted partition from one machine to another and noticed how all the permissions sort of got smashed, especially if you didn't have the default everybody can do everything permissions, you'll have experienced that, and you will have had to go in with either the GUI tools or
cackles or X cackles to go in and sanitize the permissions so that you can do sensible things again.
Windows XP Professional and Vista Business, and I think every other Microsoft product basically, is limited to 10 maximum simultaneous file sharing connections. Because I want you to buy their nice server if otherwise. Printer sharing!
Oh, just very briefly. This is why you don't use one of the desktops as the main file server as your office grows indefinitely. Because you will exceed the 10-user limit eventually, and you'll be like, oh, why can't anybody connect to the file server? Oops. Okay, printers, here we go.
All right. Share printer in Windows XP. Select Start Control Panel, Printers and Faxes. Right-click the printer icon and select Sharing. Click the Share This Printer, and then click OK. Now the printer is available for other computers to access. But you will need to have the drivers to access a printer shared by another computer in Windows XP. Select Start Control Panel, Printers and Faxes. Click File, Add Printer. Use the Add Printer wizard to find and install the shared network printer. As I said, unless your printer has, or unless the other computer has all of the drivers for you, you're going to probably have to go get the drivers for the other printer. Share printer in Vista or 7, select Start Control Panel Printers, right-click the printers icon and select Share, change sharing options, continue, click Share This Printer, and then click OK. And now you've got your printer shared, and you are going to do the same thing for Vista to get to your computer, Control Panel, Printers, click Add a Printer, use that printer wizard to find and install your printer. So, there you go. You guys get
and
to
see Chapter
do
7 if you want more printer stuff.
Basically, yeah.
And Jem, Sean mentioned if you're running multiple different operating systems, watch which default print drivers are cached on the network drivers. On the share for the printers, because putting XP drivers onto a Vista 7 machine is really pretty.
Yeah, that was so much fun.
Alright. You guys have a lab that I want to talk about. Configuring browser settings in Windows XP and Vista 7. This is actually a really cool lab. Don't be afraid of installing Firefox, because that's one thing you're going to get to do. It will not eat you. In fact, this lab will guide you through making sure that it is not your default browser and lives happily on its own until you need it for WebVism or something. So a very good lab to actually do.
Yeah, having an having more than one browser is a good thing, because some sites just will like one and not the other. I will say that we've experienced that JAWS Firefox support is lagging behind Internet Explorer, so I personally am using Internet Explorer now, not because I would prefer to use Firefox, but JAWS works so much better with Internet Explorer that I feel that I should use it. So.
Okay, what were you going to say, Brian?
Do we get to go play with about:config? That's a fun...
No.
No,
we don't go there.
In Firefox or IE? I think that's a Firefox thing, isn't it?
Yeah, you don't get to do that. It's just basically GUI settings and changing default web browsers and looking at history and stuff.
I think that's also available through the config manager under the tools menu, isn't it? For the menu crawlers amongst us?
Yeah, some of it, but I don't. Mostly about:config stuff is hidden until you actually go about config and accept the warning screen that you might break.
Yeah, and you say, I'll be careful, I promise.
Actually, I think there's actually... Yeah, I'll have to check that, but I think if you actually go in through the config editor, it throws up the same warning screen, but I'll have to see if the two are different. But yeah, that's a lot of fun stuff in there that you can break stuff quite nastily. So before you even do this, if you are going to do this, I'd strongly recommend, if anybody hasn't seen it, there's an application called Moz Backup. And it backs up Thunderbird and Firefox profiles, and it's such a really useful thing to have. You can back the profiles up before you play absolute havoc with the browser. So that's Moz Backup, M-O-Z Backup, and it rocks. We use it to taking all of our Firefox and Thunderbird settings, scripts, passwords, the works from machine to machine.
That's an invaluable tool. That's how I've configured all my machines. I set up Thunderbird just the way I wanted on one and used it and keep them on a network, and away we go.
Absolutely, that's what I do. It's fantastic. And you don't have to keep all your email messages, just all the settings will do.
Unless you use POP. If you're using POP, you'd better keep all your email messages. If you're using IMAP, you can hammer the network and fetch them back down.
Oh, somebody wanted to know what about colon config was. It's basically this page that lets you get to all kinds of settings, some of which are really good, some of which are things that most of us casual users should not be playing with. And you can do some interesting things in there.
It basically opens the cover on all of the configurable knobs, dials, switches, and levers on Firefox. And as I say regularly, when it breaks, you get to keep both pieces, or multiple pieces, depending on how
there is actually. There was a Fred's Head article, or an article somewhere, that said some that you could keep. One of them that I found particularly useful was you could set it so the hotkeys would be like Alt-S instead of Alt-Shift-S and so on. So there are some, if you're careful and you have a look around before you go in about colon config, there are some good things you can change in there. You just have to know where and find an article you trust to tell you about it.
Okay, we're going to go on to upgrading the network. Eventually, the customers may want to upgrade their network for increased speed or functionality. It will be your job to recommend to them the equipment that they need. So you will need to know to actually talk to them, see what kind of things they can afford, and see what kind of things they want to do in order to tell them about what equipment they need. Okay, we're going to talk about installing a wireless NIC. We really went over this, didn't we, last time. A wireless adapter is used to communicate with other wireless devices such as computers, printers, or wireless access points. Yeah. Before we purchase the adapter, make sure it's compatible with other wireless equipment that is already installed on the network. Also, verify that the wireless adapter is the correct form factor for the customer's computer. You can use a USB adapter with any desktop or laptop computer as long as it's got a USB port. So when in doubt, go for that if you don't want to open up the computer. to install...
Because some people just shouldn't.
Or maybe you just... they don't want you to for some reason.
Yeah.
To install an internal wireless NIC in a desktop computer, you remove the case cover, put the card into an available PCI slot or PCI Express slot. Most wireless cards have an antenna that connects to the back of the card. Some of these antennas are attached to a cable so that they can be positioned for best signal reception. You're going to feel a little round type of jack. It kind of looks like what you'd plug your cable TV into. And you put the antenna on, you screw it on, and you make sure that it's pointing upwards, if at all possible. After you install the card, you want to install the drivers and enter the IP address information unless you're going DHCP. If this is configured with a static IP address, you may need to change the address if your computer joins a different network. Therefore, it's probably better to enable DHCP on your computer to receive the DHCP information from the server.
Just a point here that I was going to make. A lot of people have these aerials on the back of their towers, and then they put the tower on the floor under their desk, and then they wonder why they've got no wireless signal, because the aerial's right up against a wall and it's hemmed in by all the bits of desk. If you actually read any of the manuals for wireless access points, they recommend that you put the gear as high as feasibly possible, so that there's less objects for the signal to go through. And sometimes it can actually pay to get an external antenna with a bit of a cable that you can actually mount up a little bit higher than the computer, and that can make the difference between no signal and some signal, especially in places like Perth where all of our houses are made of double brick.
I hadn't thought about that. That's a fair point.
Yep, Carol's having that problem as we speak. All right.
The whole access point might need to be up high.
Oh, it is. Don't worry. It's up on our bench. But one of the antennas has failed out, so I've got to get her a new one.
Oh.
Anyway, any questions on installing wireless cards? It's pretty self-explanatory. Sometimes these things will actually try and use a wizard. If the wizard isn't accessible and you don't like the software, you can always tell Windows to manage your wireless networks.
Not always. Remember those really cheap Oriental dongles we purchased off Zazz?
Oh, yes.
If you don't run the control software, you can't use the dongle, and you actually have to use the control software. So most of the time, 95% of the time, you will get that. Yeah, Grace doesn't know it yet, but I think she's off looking for aerials on eBay at some point for the wireless problem that we spoke about earlier, before I go and pay lots of money from the local supplier.
Fair enough.
Yeah, Netgear seems to be causing us some problems at the moment with that, with the USB dongle. It doesn't seem to want to get rid of. I mean, it works for them, but like, it kept popping up this message box that said, "You are connected." Well, that's great, but if I had gone onto the internet, I would have realized, and you wouldn't have had to throw up this stupid dialogue box at me. Thanks.
But it's telling you, because you must want to know, Sean.
It's also possible the signal is dropping in and out. If you walk between it with the free talks, you may have knocked the signal out, and maybe the box needs to come back up again.
Yeah,
a lot of my N access point, for example, has no antenna and no place to connect an antenna. A lot of these new things seem to just have internal ones, which is a bit irritating.
Oh, yeah, you don't have to put your big bad aerial on it.
Yeah, a lot of them are internal antennas now, and they're all inside the case. And the other problem is that you don't always know where the antennas are inside the case, so it's difficult to actually figure out which way the device has to sit for correct polarization, which is another problem. So whilst you might not have a choice, if you have any choice at all, avoid devices that have antennas hardwired in wherever possible, and also avoid devices that have internal antennas wherever possible. However, if you don't have a choice, yeah, they work fine. You just can't beef them up and put bigger antennas and things on them, and sometimes that's important, especially because Murphy's Law says that the wireless access point will be up the front of the house in the lounge room, and the study will be right down the other end of the house in the far corner, just 10 meters away from the back shed, and they will have a signal problem from those two points.
Okay. Any other questions on wireless cards before we go into wireless routers / access points? Cool. A wireless access point only provides connectivity to the network, while a wireless router provides additional features like DHCP and usually a firewall. you have to decide where you want to install an access point and then configure them. This is how you install an access point. And you want to make sure that this is going to be in a central location so that, if at all possible, everybody is going to be able to access the wireless network from wherever they need to be. Okay, use a floor plan to find the locations for access points that allows maximum coverage. The best place for a wireless access point is at the center of an area you're covering, because these do not go in only one direction, with a line of sight between the wireless device and the access point, if you can do that. Connect the access point to the existing network. most routers have 4 or 5 ports, possibly more. Connect a DSL or cable modem to the point labeled Internet. Usually this is on one of the ends. Switch logic of the device...
It might also be called WAN.
Yeah. Switch logic of the device forwards all of the packets through the port when there is communication to and from the Internet and other connected computers. Connect one computer to any of the remaining ports to access the configuration web interface, web pages. Turn on the broadband modem and plug in the power cord to the router. When the modem finishes establishing a connection to the ISP, the router automatically communicates with the modem to receive network information from the ISP that is necessary to gain access to the Internet. For example, IP addresses, subnet masks, and DNS server addresses. The Internet LED should light up to indicate communication with the modem. when the router has established communication with the modem, you need to configure the router to communicate with the devices on the network. Turn on the computer that's connected to the router, open a web browser, and you're going to enter the default configuration address, which you can get from the manual, / go Google it up on a different computer that has internet access, / guess until you get it right. A lot of times it's 192.168.1.1, but it could be all sorts of other things.
Or if you're really hardcore, you get a machine and you ping the broadcast address of 255.255.255.255 and which watch for which machine actually responds from the ICMP, and you go, ah, that's the router address.
A lot of routers use the you'll be asked for a username and password. A lot of them use a blank username field and the password admin, or admin admin, or admin and password. Or go and Google it, because I'm sure you'll probably be able to find it unless your ISP has done bad things to your router.
Also, if you are not on the internet yet, I know this, we're talking about network upgrades, but if you're not on the internet and you can't go Google it, and you can't go Google it, and you can't go Google it, do pull the CD out of the box. It's usually got the manual on it. And funnily enough, on about page 2 or 3, the defaults are actually written in the manual. So I know it sounds a bit old-fashioned, but it does sometimes work.
This section talks a lot about a specific Linksys router. So if you've got this router or have a Linksys, good for you. Otherwise, your screens are going to be different. Some of the configurations that can help to secure your network are 802.11 protocol selection of a static IP address, configuration services set identifier, setting firmware updates, saying that this protocol can provide increased throughput based on the wireless network environment. If all wireless devices connect with the same 802.11 standard, so if you've got all G's, maximum speeds can be maintained for the standard. If the access point is configured to accept only one standard device, and the devices do not use that standard, they won't be able to connect to the access point. So that's why you're usually using mixed mode networks. So BGN is very common. the static IP configuration gives you better protection against network attacks than DHCP. For example, if you've got a static IP address, it allows the firewall to be configured to permit specific traffic or connections between specific devices. there are lots of disadvantages to configuring things this way as well for large networks. It's more time-consuming to assign the static IP addresses and more difficult to manage than using DHCP assignments.
Actually, if you only have a couple of machines and you can do the static IP addresses and you can shut DHCP off, it's actually quite a kick in the teeth, because if somebody does bust into your wireless network, they're not going to be automatically assigned an IP address. And if you're on a non-standard range, that will be another thing that will slow them down.
So if they don't if you don't have a DHCP server running, there's absolutely nothing they can do to get onto your network. You have to assign them.
No, that's not true. Specifically. They can connect to the wireless access point and then watch for ARP broadcasts, and then by looking at the ARP broadcasts, they then deduce which IP addresses are on the network, and then they guess one. But it is sort of a bit of a stumbling block to slow them down. Sorry, you were going to say something, Brian? I didn't mean to cut you off.
Okay.
No, you went first. I actually just wanted to see if I could do it, then I really needed it. But I actually have my wireless on a separate subnet from all my static IP wired machines. And not that it'll slow anyone down a whole lot, but they do would have to figure out another range to get to anything useful.
Uh-huh. Sweet.
That's actually a cool idea. The other thing you can do if you're really paranoid and security conscious is, and it doesn't work for a lot of note takers and stuff, which is why we haven't done it here, is you can actually get OpenVPN running on your Linksys device, and then you connect to the wireless over OpenVPN, and nobody's getting in when you do that. That's kind of cool too.
Yeah, the note takers would be out of luck, and the iPods too, I think.
iPods do have VPN support. You can put in VPN.
Yeah, but it's only the Microsofty stuff, the insecure PPTP stuff. I don't know whether there's an open VPN for the iPod. Somebody may have ported it. I'll have to have a look, but it'll probably
be a jailbreak.
Well, yeah.
That was all creepy.
The SSID is the name of the wireless network. So, you know, Bingo is the name of our network over here. The SSID broadcast allows other devices to automatically discover the name of the wireless network. When the SSID broadcast is disabled, you must manually enter the SSID on the wireless device. This is going to provide protections from people automatically discovering your network. But it can be more trouble than it's worth in big organizations, because you've got to actually go and help all of the users that might not be the brightest set up their wireless.
Actually, change this, guys, because so many of them are Linksys blah blah blah, and there's a joke going around that says Linksys is the world's largest ISP because people don't change it. And you find a Linksys and it's open, and bang, you're online, even though you really shouldn't be using other wireless connections that you don't have permission to use because it's illegal.
Yeah, you wouldn't think
about
it. Yeah. It's totally illegal to do that.
Well, it's illegal if the person actually catches you and convicts you. It's a bit like one of those iffy things as to if you leave the front door open, you know, how illegal is it for everybody to come in and nick your stuff? You've also got to, you know, realize that the stuff was nicked. And there are a lot of people who've actually had their networks, people on their networks. I had an incident where a couple of my friends lived in a flat, and they were trying to figure out why their internet wouldn't come up, and they were reconfiguring this router and upgrading its firmware and doing all these other things to it. And then they realized that they'd actually just reconfigured and upgraded and fixed their neighbor's wireless router. And whoa, they went down to their neighbors and said, "I'm so terribly sorry." And their neighbor said, "No problem. Thanks. Thanks for that. Can you now show us how to secure it and stuff?" And this girl's like, "Yep, sure I can. I'm genuinely sorry, but yeah, I've just upgraded your firmware and rejigged your internet connection."
Aww.
I guess my objection to, and tell me if I'm breaking up and sounding weird, my objection to the analogy of it being like a door that you leave open is fine up until the and nick your stuff bit, because really, I mean, if you're sharing an internet connection, unless you're like going onto their computer and looking at what they have and taking, you know, stuff of theirs and deleting stuff and causing mischief like that, you're not taking anything. You're just sort
yes,
of
you are. You in out. Australia, you are, Drew. You're taking their bandwidth.
Well, yeah, if you have a bandwidth cap.
But you're also taking their quality of service, so it is theft of services. If you're torrenting down the 11 seasons of MASH on their network and they can't load Facebook, that's denial of service.
Yeah, well, I mean, yes, everybody's gone out into their backyard to go send an email on their note taker or whatever. No, that's probably not hurting their quality of service, but yes, people can be that dickish and they can go and download all of these torrents and stuff.
Yeah. In fact, no, I mean, I get it if, like, you're using someone else's connection to do illegal stuff. Like, you know, I don't know, like, look at child porn or something like that. Like, that's really not cool, and I understand that. But I don't really see a problem with using someone else's unsecured wireless connection to just do, like, email and internet and stuff.
Well, you have to also consider that it's
a matter of what you do with it.
What were you saying? What'd you say, Marshall?
One of the security lists I'm on reported a guy being convicted for grabbing his neighbor's wireless router and then sending a death threat to the Vice President of the United States as the neighbor.
Oops.
Whoa!
Ow.
That is not the smart thing to do.
That is so uncool.
I think the other problem is that, Drew, and I think it's pretty
at least use a proxy if you're going to do that. Don't use someone else's connection.
They sent it as the neighbor, Drew.
Come on, man.
I think the other thing to keep in mind, Drew, is that you don't know whether it's going to impact somebody else, and you don't know whether it's going to impact their services, and you don't know how it's going to impact them. So from that perspective, it's still the wrong thing to do. And there are some very prominent members of the blind community who will not have their names mentioned that actually nick their wireless connectivity on a regular basis. So it is becoming quite a part
of it.
Or
they
dumb enough to tweet about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Now, here's the other thing I was going to mention. When you're on an unsecured network, the potential exists for people to use packet sniffing and other technologies to get the password to your email or your MSN Messenger or your whatever. So,
or your credit card number.
You do take a risk every time you go on to. And actually, there was a book I was reading, and what people would do if they lived near a Starbucks or a place that had prominent free Wi-Fi that everybody knew about, they would set up a network with a similar enough name that people wouldn't pay attention. They'd connect to what they thought was Starbucks, and they'd do their email or whatever web surfing, and then their passwords would be snapped.
What was that exploit for web browsers that would actually get your Facebook credentials and a whole lot of login credentials? Does anybody remember what that one was called?
It
came out a month
Fire
or two
Sheep
ago.
Or something?
Yes, I think it was. I think it was FireSheep. And what it would do is... Sorry, go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, it was FireSheep. That's, and it was actually very cool. You were saying what it would do. Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, it would basically allow you, once you'd actually, when you logged into Facebook and stuff, it would actually snarf the authentication cookies once you'd logged into Facebook. And a lot of sites got their fingers burnt because what they were doing was they were making the login process secure, and then they were going back into clear text, and then they were actually storing some authentication cookies, and if they actually had the authentication cookies, you could get back into the site. So all you had to do was nick somebody's authentication cookies, log back into Facebook, and then you could actually get in as someone else. Grace is just getting a drink of water, so talk amongst yourselves. But very scary stuff. So Facebook and all these sorts of things weren't as secure as what you thought. And once you had somebody's authentication cookies, you could start posting random things to their Facebook timeline.
There are extensions that are out there and that to try and make it so that you're browsing SSL on more sites and are aware that you're doing it. I think one of them was called SSL Anywhere or Secure Anywhere. You can also set my Twitter client to do Twitter in SSL if I want. Obviously, it would be slower for everything to be in SSL, but it's certainly something I've thought about.
If, I don't know if anyone's mentioned this, but if anyone is on the System Access Network by Ceratec, that is done through SSL. Pretty much all the sites are sent through an SSL connection to your computer.
That's nice as far as it goes, but you've got to ask yourself how the underlying cookies and login tokens and stuff are stored. And I'm sure it's fine, but it's something you have to look into. And I think the interesting point here was that just having SSL doesn't mean you're secure. It's up to the underlying systems. But anyway, let's get back on track. But interesting problem, and yes, you do run a risk of this. And in fact, under Windows 7 and... I don't think Vista is quite as funky, but it's fairly good. What you can do is set up these unprotected networks as public networks, and you can actually turn the firewall on for the public networks and have it off for home and work so that you actually have some level of protection, or install some third-party
security
thing. Yeah, it's very cool. So the firewalls are off for home and work, but it's on for public.
I like that.
Okay. Let's see where we were. Talking about firmware updates, these can improve performance, fix bugs, or update security features. When updating the firmware, it is very vital to follow the manufacturer's instructions. You will also want to actually go and back up your settings if that is possible on your router, which most of them it is.
Warning. No, there are a whole stack of routers that when you update the configuration, you cannot restore the configuration from an older version. Do follow the manufacturer's instructions. Been bitten by that one before.
Basically, what I did for mine is before I updated, I went and recorded and had JAWS read every page of the router, and also I went through and read the help page, especially because I was flashing a totally different firmware onto mine, but I thought, well, I need to know what all of these settings are so I can get to some semblance of what it was, because I was gonna totally blow away the configuration anyway.
Are you enjoying
that?
Tomorrow?
Might be a good way.
Curiosity?
Gary, it has not died once since I flashed it, and that was a couple weeks ago. It's working amazingly well here.
We might kick the tires on that, I think. That could be fun.
Still haven't figured out how to do port forwards with it yet, but at the moment I don't need to, so it'll be one of those things when I need to, then I'll figure it out. Which, if I go to Top Speed 3, I'll need to.
Okay, the place we get our firmwares is nowhere else but the manufacturer's website or from the applet in the router that might let you download them. The access point can stop functioning if the update fails to complete, so don't touch it once you start messing with it.
JTAG cable anyone?
The other thing you'll want to do, you will get information about when the upload of the firmware has finished, but the browser doesn't tell you about when that's done. So Carrie suggested that what I do, and I actually did, take an AM radio, put it on top of your router, and listen to all the cool sounds, and when they sort of settle back down again, then refresh your browser, and because hopefully by that time the firmware will have finished. I've started doing that to a lot of things, to listen to the sounds they make.
That is a really handy tip, actually, guys. I mean, I know we keep talking about it every few weeks, but $10, $5 AM radio near your gear can give you a lot of clues as to what's going on and what's happening.
Put it relatively low on the band, on the AM band. The lower down toward the bottom you get, the better.
Someone should do a podcast on that.
That can happen.
I could show you over Skype.
Yeah, I was just thinking like a tutorial for people to see. Yeah. What happens
in like a Thursday chat?
Just a little curiosity. Can anybody get Linksys firmware lately? I went to try and get one today, and I couldn't navigate at all on their site.
Oh, that's ftp.linksys.com is the best way to do that, and I think that still exists.
Yeah.
The FTP is probably your easiest way of finding it, because their site is a giant nightmare. I've never seen anything quite like it. It is possible to do it, but it's really confusing.
It's called the Cisco website, and it's worse. Anyone been to cisco.com? That's not pleasant.
Eee.
And it's okay, I've spoken to the people at Cisco, they agree with me.
You know, they do work in networking technology. You think the website would be better?
No, that's content management and design. That's not network technology. Grim.
No, they're completely different.
Okay, that's basically it for upgrading the firmware. So next, once we've got all of this...
One other tiny thing, sorry. Don't upgrade the firmware over wireless. That is a really bad idea. Cable yourself in if you've got... if you've got a wire thing, then do wire in. Sorry about that. I was making about 30% sense there because MSN was confusing me. I hope everybody got the idea. Wire yourself into your router if you're going to upgrade the firmware. Don't do it over the wireless. And whilst you might be the gambling sort of person, if you are, make sure you've got another router ready to switch in case that one goes and doesn't come up again. Because soldering in a JTAG into the Linksys is not cool, and a lot of the other routers don't support JTAG. And if you know how to do that, then you're doing well, and probably, that's not your average user.
Okay, so the next thing we need to do is test the wireless network. Even though Windows indicates that you're connected, Windows 7 is much better about this. It'll actually tell you if you have internet access or network access only. The messages are a lot clearer. It says you might be connected but not connected to the internet. Now you usually know. The easiest way to test for an internet connection is to open a web browser and see if the internet works. To troubleshoot a wireless connection, if it doesn't work, you can use Windows by GUI or CLI. to verify a connection using XP's GUI, control panel network connections, double-click the wireless network connection to display the status. The connection status screen will displays a number of packets that have been sent and received. The packets are communications between the computer and the network device. The window shows whether the computer is connected or if it's connected along with the speed and duration of the connection. To display the address type, choose the support tab on the connection status screen. The connection status shows either a static address, which is assigned manually, or your dynamic address, which is assigned by the DHCP server. The subnet mask and default gateway are also there as well. To access the MAC address and other information about the IP address, click Details. If the connection is not functioning correctly, click the Repair to reset the connection information and attempt to establish a new connection. And you know what? Turning it off and on again, unplugging and plugging it in, all of that may not work, but Repair, funnily enough, sometimes it will just make it go. And I don't know why, because you're basically done most of the stuff that Repair would do anyway. But there's just something about that that can sometimes make things work.
And if things go really, really bad, there's actually an option under Net SH that will allow you to rejig the entire TCP/IP stack. I can't remember what that option is, but that can also fix things as well. But that is a last resort.
Well, you can uninstall and reinstall that from the properties of the network connection.
No. You can do that, but NetSH actually redoes all the registry entries and stuff and tidies everything up in case you've managed to munge up the internal configuration of the protocols. It also allows you to do things like batch network configuration and stuff. You can actually reconfigure a whole machine from a text script so that you can configure 5 or 6 network interfaces in one fell swoop.
Cool.
All right. To do the same thing in Vista, you are going to double-click, or you're going to go to the Network and Sharing Center, go to Manage Network Connections, and for Windows 7, this is Change Adapter Settings, everybody. And this confuses a lot of people. It's Change Adapter Settings. To display the status, click the Details button on the Connection Status screen. The connection status information includes the same information that you're basically going to get in Windows XP that we were just talking about. If the connection is not functioning correctly, click the Diagnose to reset the connection information and attempt to establish a new connection. I believe this is the Troubleshoot button in Windows 7. One of our favorite tools we'll talk about is ipconfig. This is a CLI, command line interface tool, that you can use to verify your valid IP address. Windows displays basic IP information for network connections. To perform specific tasks, add options to the ipconfig command. And there's a figure here that will tell you all sorts of options that you can add. We talked about ping. It's another command line tool. It tests connectivity between devices. You can test your own connection by pinging your computer. To test your computer, ping your NIC. In Windows XP, you're going to open up a command prompt. At the command prompt, enter ping space localhost, localhost. This command lets you know that your adapter is working properly. Ping a public IP address outside of your network to check if the WAN connection is working properly. You can find the address for the default gateway by pinging the by using the ipconfig command to test the internet connection and DNS. Ping a popular website. You're going to go back to your command line and you're going to enter ping destination or and then destination name, so www.cisco.com. The response of the ping command...
I prefer to ping 127.0.0.1 instead of localhost, but maybe that's just because I'm geeky enough to know that that's what localhost actually is.
I don't think cisco.com responds to pings anymore.
Yes, it does. Oh, it used to.
No, it's a discrepancy in the notes. Anybody get cisco.com to respond to a ping?
I seem to recall them saying in some lab that it didn't, and that there was a reason why. Like, now try something else, and it won't, because da-da-da-da.
Cisco.com
like, yeah, shut that off.
It does.
Oh, now I get request
timed out.
I get timed out.
Yeah, so I wouldn't do Cisco.
Minimum is 81 MS, maximum is 91 MS.
Well, maybe they like you in Canada for some reason.
What did you put in?
www.cisco.com or cisco.com? Did you actually put the...
Cisco, www.cisco.com.
Okay. Mine gets pinging.
Maybe they're put the www.
They probably have multiple web servers, and maybe one of them is just configured to respond to pings, and another one isn't.
Yeah, that's weird.
Mine's for 198.133.119.25, and I get no response.
Yeah, same here.
Mine's a 72.163.
Odd.
4.161.
Probably different IP.
Is what I've got here. So you've got. Huh. Is that the one you've got?
Okay, so, yeah, it's not reliable, okay, so,
okay, I know what you've done, Aiden. You've typed in cisco.netacat.net, which does respond.
No, it's just, no, www.cisco.com.
Okay, because I'm getting the 72 IP address when I do cisco.netacat.net.
Interesting.
It says pinging origin www.cisco.com.
Yeah, that's what I see too, is pinging origin.
But you get a different IP because of the routing, I think. Well, so there you go. Your DNSs are mapping it to a different address to ours because you're located in a different place.
I've got
Google
72.
Google will usually work for pings.
163.6.223.
Hey, here's a thought, guys. Yeah. Ring your ISP and they might be able to tell you something of theirs that's pingable, and that's certainly a lot closer and a lot safer. These things do come and go. Google.com.au usually responds, or Google.com will certainly respond to pings, but it's certainly not a sure thing. So, and often the ISP people will be more than happy to give you the address of something that will respond to pings. So, for example, if I ping www.iinet.net.au, it replies no problems because I'm on their network.
Example.com also works. And example.com is an actual domain that's specifically for documentation and stuff. If you go to example.com, you'll see what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Yeah, that's actually... I've seen that one before, actually.
there's a figure here that shows you all sorts of options you can add to ping if you want to. As well.
I want to mention quickly that on Linux and Mac... At least on Mac-A will give you an audible ping when the ping reply That's comes back. Cool. And on the Mac, if you need to adjust how many there are, because the Mac will just go and go and go and go until you stop. So -C4 is usually what I do.
There is a -T option that allows Windows to keep going and going as well. But I don't believe Windows has the audible ping. I don't remember seeing it in the options.
No, I don't think so. It's quite handy.
Oh, that is pretty cool. Alright, the next testing tool we'll talk about is TraceRoute, which is used to trace the route that the packets take from your computer to a destination address. In Windows XP, you're going to open a command prompt and enter TRACERT. The first listing in the window for the TraceRoute result is your default gateway. Each listing after that is a router that the packets are traveling through to reach the destination. Traceroute shows you where packets are stopping, indicating where the problem is occurring. If there are listings that show problems after the default gateway, it may mean that the problems are with the ISP, the internet, or the destination server, depending on what it is. All right, we've got the NET command, or NET command. The NET command is used to manage network computers, servers, and resources like drives and printers. NET commands use the NET BIOS protocol in Windows. These commands are used to start, stop, and configure network services. And you can see more about that in Figure 6. NS Lookup is a CLI tool for testing and troubleshooting DNS servers. The NS Lookup command queries the DNS server to discover IP addresses or host names. In Windows XP, select Start, Run, CMD. At the command prompt, enter nslookup space hostname. NSLookup returns the IP address for the hostname that you enter. A reverse lookup command, nslookup IP address, returns the correct hostname for the IP address entered. Okay, any questions on any of those tools? Fantastic.
Grace is scrolling, just in case you guys didn't know. She didn't key up for that.
Oh, no? Okay. Well, sorry about that.
If you talk quietly, your sensitivity is set just so that you can sort of mumble and curse very quietly and they won't hear you.
Well, I usually don't.
No, you don't. But you could. That's the point.
Still scrolling through all of this goodness that you guys can look at. All right. Now we get to talk about configuring a mail server. An email system is the client software is going to be on the user device. Can anyone name an email client? Clients.
Lookout Distress. I mean, yep, Outlook Express.
Thunderbird.
Eudora.
Does that even count anymore?
Yes, it's actually there is a new.
Oh wow.
There is a new version that's inaccessible, but the old version still works. Okay, you might not like it, and maybe drives you insane, but it is an email client that is free and still works.
That would certainly bring me back. I thought Eudora was okay. Yeah.
It was, but the old version has security flaws that you wouldn't believe now.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. But
okay. when setting up your client, your server may give you a choice of two protocols: post office protocol, POP, or internet messaging protocol, IMAP. the client sends email to the server using simple mail transfer protocol, SMTP. You need to know how to configure client for setting up email. Has anyone actually not set up an email server or an email client?
I have to do it with every new student.
Okay, I'm pretty sure everybody knows how to do this. If you don't, hey, have a talk to me and we'll talk about it. Otherwise, you've got information about this here. we've got to actually just set it up. You put in your username, password, put in the server information. If you get it right, you know what? It usually goes, and you're all good. You've got to talk to your customers if they do have a choice between POP and IMAP and give them the pros and cons of each. IMAP is usually a better way to go because then every computer has an inbox that looks identical.
Not an address book that is identical unless you're Brian and Dropbox them. Watch out for that.
Alright.
That's actually a really good idea.
Yeah, that's why I mentioned it. However, you've got to know exactly which files you're Dropboxing and make it happen. You can Dropbox the whole profile if you live in America and you haven't been hit by a volume cap yet, but Dropboxing 2 gig of Thunderbird profile is probably not a good idea for me. Even though my Dropbox does have the space for it, it's probably not a good idea to sync that much.
Selective sync is wonderful.
Yeah, but you have to sync the whole profile, and the whole profile is 2 gig. That's my point.
You're saying know which files in there are the actual address book and deal with those.
Yeah, you could, but you'd have to do that on every machine, and that could get tedious real quick.
Okay. Common email servers are Microsoft Exchange, Sendmail, Eudora Internet Mail Server, EIMS. There are often wizards and tools available to guide you in setting up an email server, but these are probably not too cheap, except Eudora, which might actually be.
Actually, just as an interesting case in point, the Mac users, there is a GUI for setting up a mail server on your Mac called MailServe for Leopard. There's probably a MailServe for Snow Leopard. And it enables inbuilt functionality in your Mac to turn on PostFix and whatever it's silly... Cyrus IMAP pop server. And it's this little GUI that you go clicky-clicky-bang and your Mac turns into a mail server.
We actually use something at work called MailNexus, which is, a third-party company that deals with the actual server and hosting and all of that, so we don't have to.
A lot of that can be very good. If you can find the right email hosting company and provider, you can actually manage all the email with web interfaces and stuff on some.
Their actual website is pretty horrendous with JAWS. That's why I use Thunderbird on a flash drive. And it was really hard to find those settings on their knowledge base, let me tell you.
Fair enough. You're going to need to do some pre-work to get this to work. For example, Microsoft, the Microsoft Exchange server. To have that, you're going to need Active Directory server, Global Catalog server, and domain name server DNS in place and functioning before you can do Exchange. An Active Directory server is a computer that hosts a database that allows centralized administration over an enterprise network. A global catalog server is a centralized repository that contains information about every domain in an enterprise network. Exchange must be installed on a domain where every computer runs at least Windows 2000. This is known as native mode. Windows NT domain controllers cannot function in a native environment. The Active Directory database is organized in a pattern called a schema. One server running Windows 2003 is designed as the Schema Master. This is the only server that can change the way the Active Directory user database is organized.
Be happy this is not tested.
No, I'm just going to say this after I basically read this all off to you guys. When the network administrator needs to modify the Active Directory structure, the change is made on the Schema Master. Active Directory then automatically copies the update to all the rest of the authentication servers. Email server installation, you're not going to be tested on this either. The best you guys really need to do is be able to set up an email client. And I think you get a lap on that. You should test the environment before you install Exchange to prevent the installation from affecting the daily operation of your network setup. The services required to install Exchange on a dedicated set of servers away from the main network. Hey, guess what? Even if you do this, guys, this may not go well. Keep the installation of Exchange separate from your production network until you are sure that it is functioning properly. Before you install Exchange, be prepared with the proper equipment and information. What?
I don't know if this is true for Windows Server 2008 R2 or Windows Server 2008, but make sure your DNS host name is set correctly before you install
Exchange.
That was
just what I was about to say.
Or God help you, because it can't be changed.
Says you want a fully functional, reliable DNS deployment.
No, but the actual host name on the Exchange server, if your computer's got the wrong name and the wrong DNS information, it's going to go very badly. This is its own personal. So if you've forgotten to rename it from, you know, gray-QVWXPZCTB, then your exchange is going to have all the wrong host names and stuff hard coded into it. And this is bad.
Fantastic. Alright. I'm going to need Windows Server support tools, your Schema Master server, high speed internet connection. Okay, after you have all of the stuff that they've been talking about, you're ready to install the mail server. You will have to add Internet Information Service, IAS, or IIS, I'm sorry, using the Add Remove Windows Component Wizard before initiating the installation of Exchange Server. This is a server that has programs used for building and administering website services. After you've installed this, Exchange can be installed. Put in the installation CD and begin the new Exchange installation wizard and pray that you got all those qualifications right. The wizard will take you through a series of steps to verify that Exchange is ready to be installed. The wizard will check to make sure that IIS is installed, the domain servers are running properly, and the Windows support tools are installed. The setup program will notify you of any problems with the installation environment. Restart the setup program from the beginning after fixing any issues. Once Exchange is installed, the Microsoft Management Console plugin for Exchange, shown in Figure 4, will provide access to many settings at one convenient location. Make sure to install all updates so that the server will run properly. The Exchange System Manager, which is a console that controls an Exchange deployment, can be used to manage the options of the server. Use Active Directory Users and Computer ADUC console to configure a user's mailbox. This is also known as making the user mailbox-enable. Open the ADUC to create a new user. Fill out the username and password information according to the domain security policy as shown in Figure 5. The user's mailbox will be created by the Exchange server when the user receives the first email. Setting up Exchange takes careful planning, including ensuring that the servers, services, and technologies are in place and working correctly on the network. In some cases during the installation, if there is a failure, you may need to reinstall the operating system and start Exchange installation from the beginning. Yeah, as I said, hold on and pray. They say before doing any of this, consult network professionals experienced in Windows networking. Yeah. All right, there you go. You aren't tested on any of that, you guys, so it's all good. Any questions? Is anyone awake?
Yes.
No. Yeah. I think so.
Yeah.
No, yeah. You're all sleeping.
I thought I'd cheat, and I thought, you know, I know a fair bit about this stuff, but I got a free one, so let's see how easy it is. I installed Small Business Server 2003 R2, and I thought, well, they're going to make this simple. It took me forever to get that DNS stuff right, and the Exchange, Qmail was significantly easier, I think.
Yeah. I have had watched people curse and swear about this stuff, so not actually done it myself. Gosh, I don't really think I'd want to, but there it is if you did.
I think the point to be made here is, and in theory, you think you're able to do it. You think, well, this can't be too difficult. I'll just boot this up and kick the tires. I know lots about email. But you've really got to have read some of Microsoft's documentation first, or been to one of their training courses, or there's all sorts of things that trip you up. And they really mean it when they say you should read the documentation first. It's true, sadly. Otherwise, it can go very badly. Assuming you can find it.
Well, there you go. That's this chapter. You guys have preventative maintenance and troubleshooting to look at on your own. And we'll test next week before going into our very last module, Module 16.